Green Scene on the Pat Kenny Show with Repack, supporting the circular economy and reducing the impact of packaging on the environment.
Now in the Green Scene today, how our food is becoming less nutritious with climate change. But first, given it is Shark Month, the colour-changing shark. We're joined by Dr. Ruth Freeman, Director of Science for Society at Research Ireland. Ruth, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
It's Shark Week.
Shark Week, yeah, which has been going on the Discovery Channel now for nearly 40 years. I think we're really interested in sharks as a species, so it's a great time to
That really is down to one thing about which we will be speaking later on in the programme, the movie Jaws.
It is, yeah. 50 years ago, Jaws premiered this week. So, but yes, the colour-changing shark, it's not a great white as the shark in Jaws is. It's the blue shark, which if people have seen it, it is an incredibly beautiful iridescent blue creature that lives in most of the oceans of the world. But this blue colour is not that common in nature. So scientists in the university in Hong Kong have been studying how the shark gets this incredible blue colour. And it seems it's down to these little tooth-like structures that sharks have in their skin. They're called denticles. And they're very like our teeth in that they are sort of pointy, but they have a cavity inside. And what they found is inside the cavity, inside these little tooth-like structures that cover the whole shark, are different little bags of pigment inside the cells. So they found there's two different pigments. One of them is guanine, which is a colour that reflects back the colour blue, not surprisingly, and it's almost like a mirror. It also gives that shimmery, silvery colour that we see in other places in nature. And then there's also melanin, which we know is a pigment that absorbs light. It's what we get in our skin when we tan. And it's like these two little, these bags of different types of pigment are interacting together to give this the shark its really, really blue colour. But that's not even the most interesting part of the story, because these two different pigments are interacting in a sort of physical sense, and they can interact differently. And that actually makes the shark change colour, which is fascinating.
Now, in what circumstances does it change colour?
Well, what we think is that it might be due to things like water pressure. What we see is when the layers of these little guanine crystals, the blue reflecting ones, get closer together, the shark gets bluer and darker in colour. When those layers are a little bit further apart, and this is happening at a nano scale, so they had to model this experimentally in silico, they find that the colour looks a little bit more green or gold. So you can easily imagine that this might be an adaptation the shark has to help it be better camouflaged, so it goes darker blue when it's going deeper into the ocean.
Okay.
And then as it reaches the surface, you're getting those goldy green colours.
The idea being that when it's down deep, where there is very little light coming through the water from the surface, that it becomes invisible to its prey.
Well, it sort of becomes, it's like stealth camouflage. And it's really fascinating because these denticles, as well as making the shark go faster, they also protect it from growing algae on it. And now this is a third property of this incredible material.
Is it at the very top of the food chain? Does it eat everything and has nothing to fear about being eaten itself?
Pretty much. I mean, orcas are one of the few creatures. Well, orcas and us, I suppose, are the main predators of sharks. But apart from that, they tend to be the apex predator in the sea. Yeah.
Okay. So they actually carry on, unless man interferes, they have a good life.
They do, but they still have to catch pretty big prey. You know, they're catching fish and marine mammals, so they've still got to have that stealth. You know, it's definitely part of what they need to survive.
Now, they travel large distances?
Well, when it comes to the white shark, and I suppose we talked about Jaws, and as you say, in some ways, Jaws is like the most famous misinformation about sharks. I mean, last year, I think 4 people died when they were attacked by sharks. So really, sharks have much more to fear from us than we have to fear from them. But Jaws really is responsible for generations of people, I have to say, including myself, being completely terrified of sharks. But I think the good side that we can look back on today is that it inspired a whole generations of shark researchers as well. Because actually before Jaws, really only the US Navy studied sharks. Nobody else was interested in them.
And presumably that was about safety of
divers
and
sailors, exactly, when they were in particularly shark-infested waters. But really that there's sharks now, shark scientists who were inspired by Jaws. One of them, Dr. Dave Ebbert, he's identified 50 new species of sharks in the world. So there's been some really incredible work done from people who were inspired by the movie. And as you say, even the great white, which now people are actually sort of dropping the great to say it's the white shark, because it isn't that dangerous really. And as you say, we're learning amazing things about them. Top of the food chain, they can migrate over, you know, tens of thousands of miles in the ocean. they can pick up a billionth of a volt in electrical activity. So, you know, a fish, an injured fish, maybe an injured seal, they can pick up electrical pulses from living things.
And find them.
But also, you know, they can be social. We think of them as these solitary, aggressive creatures, and they usually are, but they can come together in a group around a whale carcass and all work together.
So it may not be the whiff of blood that attracts them to a wounded prey. It could be this little electrical...
It's both. You know, they just are these amazing creatures. So I think when it comes to Jaws particularly, you know, we've moved on from that film, even though it is an incredible film, and now we're thinking more about how sharks are incredible and maybe what we can learn from them, because some of these adaptations might be incredibly interesting for us.
Now, let's move on to something else. And we're always talking about climate change and global warming and so on. And what you want to talk about is how it might impact on our food.
Yeah. And we know that our food is potentially becoming less nutritious. And this is becoming lots of different reasons. It's the health of our soil. It also might to do with pesticides and fertilizers, and also the crops that we've selected. Often we're selecting crops now for things like longevity on the shelf, maybe, as opposed to their nutritional value. So we know that when we look at things like iron, zinc, calcium, that the levels in some foods have dropped by about 50% over the last 60 years. But this is research from John Moore University in Liverpool, and the researchers were particularly interested in the impact of different CO2 levels in the atmosphere and also different temperatures. So they have these special kind of chambers that they have where they can grow vegetables and they can mimic what might be future climate scenarios.
Imagine that, you know, the absorption of CO2 is good for a plant.
Well, CO2 is the food for plants. It's what they convert to sugar. And that is true. When you see slightly higher CO2 levels, you do potentially initially see better growth in the plants. But what they did was when plants have grown under these higher CO2 conditions, the researchers then used very detailed analytics looking at the breaking down the chemical composition of the plants. And what they found is a further reduction in nutritional value. So while the plants are potentially growing bigger and faster, things like calcium and some of the really important components like the antioxidants, people will have heard of these things as giving a real health benefit to things like spinach, kale, green vegetables. The levels of these are lower.
So you might be getting more sugar and less of the vital things.
Exactly. And of course, that's just with the CO2. What we see with climate change is not only increased CO2, but usually also increased temperature and then potentially also things like water stress. And when we add in those other factors, of course, we sort of erode the benefits that we might get from the increased growth. So I suppose what we're thinking about now is, are we facing a future where, as you say, we have maybe more food, but higher in sugar, lower in nutrients? And will that feed in, particularly in places in the world where there are droughts and people are suffering from nutritional deficiency, from famines? This is sort of another layer in that challenge when it comes to global food systems.
And of course, we might be planting things that don't normally get planted here, for example, if we're warmed up a bit. Although I don't know, because, you know, if the Gulf Stream stops, we're going to freeze.
Yeah, and this is where...
Which way is it going?
Well, we don't know. And climate models are just that. You know, they are incredibly complicated. And we're doing our best to try and understand trends. But at the moment, certainly the trend that we see of increasing greenhouse gases and overall increasing temperature, particularly in Europe, is something that we do need to think about when it comes to our food.
Okay, I suppose the law of unintended consequences plays into all of this. Things that we do and we don't know downstream what it's going to be. Dr. Ruth Freeman, Director of Science for Society at Research Ireland, thank you very much.
Green Scene on the Pat Kenny Show with Repack, supporting the circular economy and reducing the impact of packaging on the environment.